Hiya, Tim here. And before the podcast, I have a quick note. Due to rights reasons, the songs have been shortened for this podcast. Every song's taken from Keane's Hopes and Fears. All tracks are written by Tim Rice Oxley, Tom Chaplin, and Richard Hughes, except She Has No Time, Sunshine, This Is The Last Time, and Bedshaped are also credited to James Sanger. It was released on 10th of May 2004 on Ireland. Enjoy.
Tim's listening party was a lockdown sensation.
Unfortunately, it was on Twitter, which you can't listen to.
But Absolute Radio has the solution.
Tim Burgess explores seminal albums alongside the artists who brought them to life.
Absolute Radio presents Tim's listening party with Tim Burgess.
Hiya, it's Tim's listening party on Absolute Radio. I'm Tim Burgess, and welcome to another episode of the show in which I sit down with a band, going through a classic album and hearing the stories behind it. So far this series, I've had listening parties with the Libertines, the B-52s and ABC. To catch up on any of these episodes, just search for Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts, where you'll find even more episodes with artists such as U2, Def Leppard, The Bangles, Sparks and more. Remember, it's not a listening party if you don't get involved on Twitter. So tweet me through the show using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party and check out @Tim_Burgess and @Absolute Radio for more listening party content. This episode, I'm joined by Tom Chaplin and Tim Rice Oxley from Keane to talk about their debut album, Hopes and Fears. One of the best-selling albums in UK history, it went 9 times platinum in the UK, selling over 10 million copies worldwide and racking up billions of streams online. The year of the album's release, 2004, saw Keane hold the crown of being the biggest-selling British artist in the country. The following year, they won 2 Brit Awards, Best British Album and British Breakthrough Act. The band emerged alongside a raft of bands who would lead the way in the noughties alternative music scene, although they were unique in that their songs were centred around the keyboard. Beyond their debut, their next 3 records all went to #1 in the UK. One of their tracks was immortalised in a John Lewis Christmas advert, and they've just completed a sellout UK arena tour. The band have celebrated their debut album's 20th anniversary not just by going on tour, but by releasing a remastered deluxe edition complete with previously unreleased demos and rarities. So, make sure to check out that too. I suppose I just want to go to the start, set the scene leading up to this, you know, incredibly, you know, successful and wonderful record. You know, what was happening?
Well, for a long time before it, not much seemed to be going right for us. I mean, which I think in the end was probably a good thing, but we toiled away. I mean, I guess the band, we knew each other as kids, but the band is sort of formally formed in, what, 97 or something?
We at school together, is that right?
Yeah. Well, in fact, we grew up in the same town and went back to the same primary and secondary school, so we knew each other from way back. But yeah, so the band had been a lifelong dream, really, even at that point.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think to begin with, we were just not very good, and we didn't really know what we were doing, like most bands.
Yeah, of course.
When they start, so there was this sort of really lengthy period of time where I think we were figuring out what exactly we were, and we were figuring out who should do what, and what the sound was going to be, and getting better at writing and performing, and all of the things.
Yeah,
that for us at least seemed to take a very
long
time.
So when did you start writing then? like 11 years old or something?
Yeah.
Six years old actually.
Yeah, probably like when we were sort of... I definitely remember being like 12, 13 and we had songs.
Anything that made the album?
Definitely not. They were pretty bad. But I suppose the fact was that we sort of locked into that idea of writing our own songs and all that sort of thing. And it seemed like such a cool thing to do, but I mean, it takes a long time to get any good at it, doesn't it?
Yeah. I was in bands, you know, ever since I can remember. I remember doing Spirit Walker and LA Woman and I Want to Be Your Dog before realising that it's probably more effective to write your own stuff and about your own experiences. But experiences don't really happen until like teens, really, do they?
Until your heart breaks.
Maybe 16-ish.
Yeah,
I think we also had this sense of, you know, as I think a lot of people do, it was just like, it was all of that stuff, even in the stuff in songs, I felt like was just stuff that happened to other people. And I guess that partly is because you're young and, you know, maybe you know, been in love or all that stuff. But I do remember then actually a big thing was getting into the Smiths and all their songs about sort of small town life and that sort of thing suddenly made it seem like, oh, okay, you know, there is something that, you know, there's something interesting in everything, which made it sort of seem more possible to that we could write something that other people might conceivably want to hear.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because, you know, at first you think that all bands are from space. And then you think, oh, they might be from America, you know. And then if...
Even more distant.
If you got someone mentioning Newport Pagnell and, you know, in his lyrics, then it's kind of like...
It was like the age of, you know, we were big U2 fans, and it was sort of that age of, like, Zoo TV, when they was like their most enormous, and, like, every gig they did, they had the Pope on the phone or something, rushed in on stage.
That's true,
though, and then, you know, on their days off, they were hanging around with Cindy Crawford and Christy Turlington. It's like, this does not seem very sort of East Sussex vibes.
But that was the goal, right?
It seemed fair.
Yeah.
Well, let's play track one from Hopes and Fears. It's Somewhere Only We Know. I'm getting tired. That was Keane with the classic Somewhere Only We Know, the first track from Hopes and Fears on Tim's Listening Party. So you started to record Hopes and Fears in, what, 2001? Is that about right?
Well, I think a few of the songs started popping up. This Is the Last Time is the first song on the record that I remember being written. Would that be 99 or something like that?
99.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah. It's a bit hard to remember, but things like This Is the Last Time, She Has No Time were quite early, weren't they?
Yeah.
And went through various versions. And I suppose they were part of our sort of songwriting education as well.
Yeah. And
also performance.
Yeah. Sort
of learning to perform as well.
Because we lived in Stoke Newington. We moved to London. The plan was to try and, you know, we'll be in London, do the Camden Circuit, try and get noticed by someone.
Yeah.
So we lived in Stoke Newington. We borrowed this ADAT machine off some guy my dad knew.
Yeah.
And it was just hours of fun, wasn't it? Just sat in that little sitting room in Stoke Newington trying to figure out how the hell to make anything that sounded good. But She Has No Time, I think I remember recording that. Yeah. And then doing a little video for it as well. Do you remember that?
I don't remember that.
Adam, our manager, who's still our manager.
Yeah, yeah,
now,
oh, good.
He was sort of connected to the film world, so he sort of set this kind of vastly over-expensive video shoot up. Do you not remember it?
I don't remember that at all.
Yeah.
That's mad.
Yeah. So with an ADAT, you need a mixing desk still, right?
Mm. Yes.
Yeah.
I think so. I'm trying to remember what the setup was.
You were the producer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tom knew all about how to work all this stuff.
Yeah, just about worked it out. But at that time, you know, as I'm sure you remember, really what you wanted was to get into a studio.
Yeah,
you didn't have any money and you were unsigned, you know, to beg, borrow and steal to get there. So we did have a couple of ins, didn't we? We met a guy called Mark Wallace, who was a producer. Did a bit of stuff for the Smiths and...
Travis.
Yeah.
And he took us under his wing a little bit.
Nice.
And invited us to work in a studio. This is the most amazing thing we've ever done. But I think through Mark, we then met James, is that right?
Yeah.
So we met this guy called James Sanger,
right,
who was a programmer, which I think is a slightly redundant title these days.
Yeah, maybe.
But back then,
he
was like, you know, people like Dido would get him in to do the beats and all that.
Yeah, sort of guy. Yeah, I remember that time.
And he had this, like, ramshackle farmhouse that he bought out in France. He said, oh, you know, come to my farmhouse for, you know, for the summer. And I suppose it was around that time, so that was 2000, wasn't it?
And it coincided, we were actually a guitar band as well, and it coincided with Dominic, the guitarist, deciding he'd had enough and was sort of going to give up the dream, which was fair enough. But that was just as we went out to do this sort of make this album with James in France. But we did have definitely had a few of the songs.
Well, we had Bed Shaped, we had This Is the Last Time, She Has No Time.
Wow.
Quite, definitely a few others that were floating around that made the record.
So with him leaving and you going to France, and I mean, and you know, the meetings that you'd had, these are all sort of shaping the way that you, I mean, obviously yeah. it was shaping the way that you were going, but you probably thought it was a problem at the time, but you know,
it is,
it's amazing how these things happen, and you know, this is like moments that just, you think, oh, that was a real significant yeah. turning point.
Yeah, as you say, it felt like a big problem when Dominic left, the yeah. guitarist, but then we sort of thought, oh, you know, we can be a kind of more kind of electronic band, didn't
yeah.
we? And
we were listening to quite a lot of Depeche Mode, weren't we?
Yeah. Right.
And we thought, oh, well, there's a way that you can sort of blend.
Yeah. Good songwriters as well.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, and we grew up like with the Pet Shop Boys and Erasure, mm-hmm. and also we were really into Royksopp. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember them. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I think initially what we had in mind was something a bit more sort of blippy bloopy.
There is a little bit of that, you know, but I mean, we start off with kind of like, you know, it's very piano and, you know, vocal, and we start off with Somewhere Only We Know,
yeah.
you know, which, I mean, what can you say about that song, you know, really?
Because we'd had such a long time sort of in the wilderness, as mm-hmm. it were, I think we felt like we're going to put a record out there, let's front load it, you know, which is why...
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
Heavy on sort of the singles, sort of up front. And I guess Somewhere Only We Know felt like, in our minds at least, like it was going to be one of our best or biggest songs, didn't it?
So you knew in the studio, you kind of knew where it was going to go, and we'd still be talking about it now. And
well, definitely not that, but I mean, we had a sense. I think, you know, because you're, at that point, obviously, you're playing, you know, you maybe get a gig every few weeks, and we, you know, you go and play at a pub and you get more, like, half an hour, 40 minutes maybe, so you've got maybe 7 songs.
Yeah.
So you're basically trying to play a set of bangers that immediately get people's attention. And I
yeah.
think, so we had quite a lot of those songs. Somewhere Only We Know felt like a big one that people just loved straight away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This Is the Last Time, I think, was a bit like that.
Yeah.
And I think you just take that mindset into your first album where you're like, oh, we've got to get people's attention, basically. But at that point, you don't have any sort of grand ideas about, you know, telling a story over 45 minutes or whatever it is. You're just like, quick, get them before they go to the bar.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, pop songs, really, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know that feeling. First albums are just magical things anyway, you know. You don't know what you're doing, but you kind of like think you do. And I remember our first single, we recorded it overnight, you know, because we were self-funding.
Yeah.
And it was called Indian Robe. I remember recording it and saying to Martin, our bass player, this is the best song that we could ever write. How are we going to follow this up?
Yeah,
that's a good feeling.
Yeah, it's a really good feeling. And then you just do, and, you know, you get another stab at it, you know.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. I don't think we had a strong sense that it was, like, a massive hit, did we? I remember thinking that the first album would be like a step up through the gears, and hopefully yeah. by, I don't know, your third album or something, yeah. you'd get quite big, because that's just what we were used to. Again, you know, trying to get the gigs a bit bigger, trying to get the tour a bit bigger, whatever it was. So it wasn't like, oh, we've got this incredible song, let's
no.
play first.
Because I remember when Tim first played the demo of it, you had a demo of it, and you played it to me and Richard, and I do remember thinking, you know, because it's got that structure where it kind of goes verse. What I thought on first listen was the chorus, you know, the simple thing bit.
Yeah.
And back to verse and then that again. And then suddenly there's this extra soaring chorus moment, which yeah. kind of took me by surprise. And I think there was just that extra bit of magic that I hadn't really heard in one of our songs before
right.
when I first heard that. And I guess that clearly was the same for lots of other people, because it's definitely endured, hasn't it?
The world decided. So how do you feel about it now? I mean,
deathly silence.
Well, very proud of it.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
very proud of it. It's so fun to play, and you know, it's like when you play that to a sort of arena full of people and they're all belting it out.
It's amazing.
You know, even,
yeah.
and especially as the years go by and you're just thinking, who are all these people who are, like, you know, were they even born when this song came out and they're still singing it? And that's just such a good feeling.
Yeah.
It's so
yeah.
nice. And you do think, like, well, maybe we've produced something that has some meaning. Do you know what I mean? That's lovely, you know. That's what you do yeah. it for, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a great song to sing, I should add. So, you know, I still love singing it.
It sounds good, you know.
Yeah.
Sounds good when you sing it.
Thank you.
Let's hear another track. The second from Hopes and Fears, Bend and Break. Tell me about that last track.
So we had 2 years in London, that had not worked. Then we went to France with James, and that sort of, you know, definitely things went up a notch at that point. But then we thought, well, let's basically try and pour every bit of energy that we have into rehearsing and trying to get even better. And so we all just decamped to our parents' houses back down in Sussex, and we would meet up and try and figure out how we were going to get somewhere and rehearse and write. It felt like the three of us kind of against the world.
Yeah.
You know, had that sort of sense to it.
You've got to feel like that as a band, though, anyway.
You know, even though there was a bit more belief from people around us, it still felt like everyone thought of us as a bit of a joke. You know, why are these guys still trying, you know? And I think I always think of Bend and Break as the song about that. I mean, may beg to differ on that, but it's like I always think of it about the three of us with this shared dream and meeting up and trying to get through to the light, which is, I guess, what the.
So is there a line that says "Meet you in the next life"? Meet you on the other side.
Meet you on the other side. Meet you in the light.
On the other side, light, and then day and night. You know, it's like whatever it takes kind of thing.
And waiting for life to begin.
It's got
that sort of. Yeah, and I think that whole sort of if only I don't bend and break was really sort of, us sort of talking to each other and just sort of trying to keep going a bit longer. Because, I completely agree with, you know, with what Tom said. I think that's exactly what it's about. And there's a lot of that. It's probably similar in some Ronnie Weno has a bit of that. I think it's just.
Right.
We were just trying to keep going because it does. You do start to feel a bit ridiculous.
It's a bit like a sort of call to arms or something, isn't it? You know, it's like, come on, we can still do this.
It's funny about when people try and write concept albums and stuff like that. But you know, it sounds like this was a concept album just by default. You know, because you'd just known each other so long, and it's the first album, isn't it? You know, just desperate's the wrong word, but you know, you've just got this one focus. You know, of trying to be heard.
Yeah.
I think that was how it felt. It just felt like you were sort of straining and sort of striving all the time just to move forward. And that's what I hear in that song.
I wrote down here, is it a feeling of absolute connection? And I really like the halftime section, around about 2 minutes and 18.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, the fact that it took us so long to actually make the record, or to get to the point where we could make the record, meant that basically if we weren't working, as in trying to make money, we were, as Tom said, tinkering around with songs every day, all day, every day. They went through so many different permutations, different versions, and people would sort of say, oh, you know, you need to be more urban, or you need to be more electronic, or you know what, or you need to be cooler, the programming needs to be cooler. And so all the time we were sort of thinking, oh, that's all right, we can try this different version of the song. At the time that was very perplexing and frustrating, but what you ended up with was these sort of hybrids of like loads of different versions of the songs, where you'd throw a load of stuff at the song, and then 6 months later you'd have a different version of the song. You'd have one little cool bit that you'd come up with for this other version. So, and I think there's a lot of that on the record. Just little sounds or little moments where we thought, oh, we'd done a half-time version of the song or something, and then you keep that section. And it all gives the songs, the recordings I should say, a load of character that they might not have had if we just, you know, bashed them out.
Well, that's really interesting to know, because I think obviously you wanted things to be speedy, you know, but having the time, you know, allow those things to happen. I mean, I'm terrible in our band. I want things to happen right now, you know, and everything. And, you know, and obviously they don't. And the more time that you get, the better the songs get. You know, I'm worried that, you know, you overdo them at times, but, you know, if you just keep rehearsing them every day.
Yeah, I guess the key is to sort of work out which are the good bits.
Yeah.
I do think you sort of wonder how, like, the Beatles sort of came up with these incredible productions in, you know, a few hours.
Yeah.
Sort of overflowing with ideas, but, you know, I don't know if that's how it always happened.
It helps if you've got Paul McCartney in the band, though.
Yeah.
That helps, doesn't it?
Fantastic. Let's play track 3 before we chat about it. This is Keen with We Might As Well Be Strangers on Absolute Radio. Might as well be strangers, the third song from Hopes and Fears. It's Tim's listening party. Tom, what can you tell me about it?
I feel like it was a last minute song. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think you're right, actually.
That didn't go through that sort of rigorous process, I don't think. And I think I remember the first time I can remember doing it would have been in the studio when we were actually making the album properly.
Yeah, that rings a bell.
Such a long time. A
latecomer. In the mists of time.
It's funny how I think you can hear, you know, what I was saying earlier about thinking about how things would sound live and wanting to keep people's attention. I think you can. There's something about the fact that it sort of kicks off at the end of that song.
Yeah.
It's like, we better not be too sort of slow and morose for too long. We need a big bit at the end.
Yeah.
You know,
that's funny.
It's still actually in our live set.
Yeah.
Now, so there's probably something in there.
Yeah.
Is it maybe about disconnecting as opposed to connecting? The others being more connection based.
Yeah,
connection based. Did I say that?
Connection based songs.
I'm becoming a broadcaster.
Connection solutions. My recollection is that Richard had a bit of a breakup, didn't he? While we were sort of working on, you know, before we'd started recording and stuff, but I think it sort of filtered down. I hope he doesn't mind me saying this now. You know, filtered into some of the songs. And I'd had one a few years earlier that I was still milking about seven
it's
or eight.
Easier to be apart was one of the lines in there, right?
Yeah, I think that idea is quite a sort of chilling, you know, I'm sure we've all been through that thing where you're sort of, you have that intense relationship and then suddenly you're sort of completely estranged from each other again and you have to sort of go back to the way you were before.
Very powerful.
Yeah.
Next up, it's another big single. They're all big songs, but everybody's changing.
Everybody's changing. That song for me is always linked to finally sort of breaking through somehow.
Yeah.
When was that? 2002? Somewhere around there.
Yeah.
It's obviously, it's very singly, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we were playing it live quite a bit, but still just labels would come to the gigs, but they just... They didn't seem that bothered, did they? But Simon Williams from Fierce Panda.
Yeah, he very enthusiastic.
He's a great guy. And he came to the Betsy Trotwood pub.
Right.
Where we were doing a show in Farringdon. You know, he just said, oh, I really like that song. You know, why don't we just put it out as a single, you know, for a run of 500 copies.
Fantastic.
See what happens.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think Steve Lamacq had then come to a subsequent gig at the Bull and Gate or somewhere like that.
Yeah.
And he obviously picked up on it and
Fantastic.
Then he played it on his evening show before we were signed, that Fierce Panda version. And it's funny because, you know, we'd gone from feeling like nobody was interested in us and you'd have to do some serious arm twisting to get anyone from a record label to come down to a gig, to suddenly, like, you know, guys, we'll pay for you to have a car to bring us to our record label. We did this like kind of little tour of the labels of London. I think we might have visited like 9 or 10 labels over the course of a few weeks, you know, because basically the reaction from people hearing Everybody's Changing on Steve's show
been so
positive.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it just, even for us, as soon as I heard it across the airwaves, I'm feeling a bit misty-eyed even thinking about it now. But
amazing.
It was like such a great feeling. And to think, oh, actually, that does sort of stand up with the rest of the stuff that I hear on the radio.
Yeah,
you know,
maybe
we're not deluding ourselves thinking that we can do this. And so it gave me that, for me, it gave me that real sense of belief. and obviously clearly for the people with the purse strings.
So did you re-record it completely then? For the album?
Basically, I think maybe some elements survived, but it's interesting because there's another one that started off, you know, I was saying about being quite soft and electronic.
Yeah.
We have, you know, it's interesting doing this because we're doing this anniversary edition with lots of demos. I've been digging back through all sort of old demos and things, and hearing the original demo of it, it's very Roycroft-y. It's sort of very, these sort of lush strings and little pianos, tiny little piano going ding ding ding. It goes on for ages, and you know, right. It doesn't have the sort of momentum or the energy of even the Fierce Panda version, let alone the album version.
So are both those versions on the box set? Or the deluxe?
I think it's certainly the original demo. Yes. Yeah. Another good example of where it went off into like this sort of minor section for a while. I don't know why we thought that was a good idea, but in the end, we chopped like two. We had two bars of that, and we put that in after the first chorus. And it suddenly goes, you know, which we kept for the album version, and it goes off in this funny little direction, and it just sort of adds a little bit of spice to the song that wouldn't have been there otherwise. But I remember doing the. We thought, oh, let's do some like, you know, that sort of open hi-hat kind of disco, like a Dancing Queen type beat.
Yeah, great.
I remember Andy Green, the producer, sort of saying, he kept saying, it's a bit dodgy disco. We're like, oh no, we've done this sort of terrible, terrible song. But anyway.
Let's hear that classic from Hopes and Fears, Everybody's Changing. Everybody's Changing by Keen. It's actually the first time that I noticed the electronics in the album, you know, so this would be like track four, and for me it's like very piano based, and I was gonna, is it an electric piano or is it a whirly, or
it's probably the Yamaha CP70, which is sort of electric acoustic hybrid that,
and every song sounds different, you know, the piano sound sounds different, but it's like, you know, very piano-y, and you know, it's really gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, we did the classic thing that you do. You know, every piece of music gear you buy at that age, like, you get very excited about it. So we sort of buy something and we think, oh, we have to use it on the next song.
Yeah.
And we went over to this little town called Bexhill and bought a Roland Juno 6 synth off this guy.
Nice.
Well, yeah, we worked out that you could sort of plug a rhythm into it and it would sort of make this pulsing noise that then runs through the whole song. You know, it was off the first.
This is the beginning of an addiction, by the way.
Oh, yeah. You got quite a collection now.
Keyboards.
Yeah. But it's funny how you just sort of think, oh, that's cool, let's put it in the song. You don't think, oh, you know, that's been done a million times before, or you're not second guessing yourself all the time. You just have these ideas, chuck them down, move on, and, you know, and that's sort of basically how most of the songs sort of.
Unselfconscious. Yeah. That's the sort of. Gets harder and harder, you know, you wrestle more and more with a sort of self-conscious attitude, don't you, towards your songs as you get older, I think, worrying about whether they're this or that. all the things that you picked up along the way, that
the baggage.
But it's at that point it's just, I think you can hear that. I suppose that's just true of most first albums. It's just,
well, there's no blueprint, is there? There's no guideline. This is like the first thing that you're doing, and you know, everything after that is based on what you did at first. It's not by the fourth or fifth album, I think. This feels a bit forced, you know. You have to shake it off, don't you?
You have to try and find that sort of wide-eyed,
the curiosity, you know?
Absolutely,
it's good to keep being curious, isn't it?
Okay,
Your Eyes Open.
It's quite a Roycroft-y one, isn't it?
You've only just reminded me of the Roycroft thing. Yeah, I remember going to see them at the Astoria.
Yeah, that's right.
That's an amazing night. But I've forgotten how much it was a kind of influence on the sound and the writing at the time. But yeah, I mean, that one, Your Eyes Open owes something to Roycroft, doesn't it?
Yeah. That was another one where, you know, I bought this electric piano thing. secondhand from a music shop, and it was kind of like a Rhodes piano type thing, but it was all electronic, if that makes any sense. But we actually used it on quite a lot of the album, like She Has No Time and Untitled One and stuff. But it had this amazingly chunky bass end to it, which is supposed to be electric piano, but it sounded like a really fat bass to me anyway.
Yeah.
I think probably a lot of that song just came from just that, but playing that bass line on that piano. It was almost like the sort of melody was and the lyrics were a bit of an afterthought.
Oh, I like It's a Long Time Since Your Heart Was Frozen. I like that. That's a good lyric.
Thank you.
Yeah. And when was it written then, do you think? Early or mid or...?
Well, I remember working on it when we were sort of meeting at your mum and dad's house. Because the sort of sea gully noise, sure that sort of opens a song.
Yeah.
I remember sort of figuring that out. I don't know where we found that, though. Did we find it from a kind of sound effects library or something like that?
Good source.
We were sort of having a bit of a, you know, like Tomorrow Never Knows moment, weren't we? we're going to get into sample.
Yeah.
And that lasted about 5 minutes. But, you know, we got one sort of cool sound out of it.
Yeah.
I think that was sort of, that was probably a bit of a heartbreak song for me. Although a lot of the kind of love songs on the album do have a sense of, like, trying to move forward and, again, sort of willing ourselves forward, a bit like Bend and Break, I think.
Yeah. That's another good line as well. It's a lonely place you have to run to.
I don't know what we were whittering on about.
Just fill some space.
Well, I like it. And here is that song, Your Eyes Open, on Tim's Listening Party. Your Eyes Open from Hopes and Fears on Absolute Radio. The next song is She Has No Time.
Well, that's one of my favourite songs off the record. I mean, like we discussed earlier, it was definitely one of the first songs that was written that ended up making Hopes and Fears.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the story of it is that I had this this failed romance when I was living in London. This girl who I sort of thought I was madly in love with, and she just kept kind of letting me down. I'd rock up to meet her and she just wouldn't turn up, and yet she somehow kept stringing me along. And I just remember one night, after another sort of miserable failed evening, I came back and I was like kicking, it was very out of character for me, but I started kind of kicking this bus shelter. I don't think I broke anything, but I was sort of felt like I was in an episode of EastEnders or something. But I was really sort of upset about it. And Tim and I were living in the same flat.
Yeah.
So he'd hear in great detail about all my sort of romantic failings. And so that song emerged.
Yeah.
Quite beautifully sometime after that. And I mean, whether or not he had me in mind, I don't know. I never really asked. It always felt like that. And again, it was particularly, I love the middle eight of that song about the lonely people tumble downwards. It just felt like, it was a sort of musical arm around my shoulder saying, it's all right, mate.
Very close up as well, like as a recording, it's like, so it's really capturing that intimacy.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would have known the song inside out. I think that was definitely something. It was definitely a song we recorded on the ADAT with guitars before, various iterations.
Yeah. I'm interested in this whole guitar thing and how it kind of changed.
Dominic, he was Irish.
Yeah,
he was an Irish guy from Dublin. Heavily influenced by The Edge.
Brilliant.
But I mean, a really great guitarist, very imaginative. And I remember on that song, there's this beautiful, like, haunting guitar part, wasn't there?
Yeah.
I can still remember it now, actually. It was just lovely. It was beautiful. I remember laying that down in the flat, probably having smoked too many joints, but thinking, wow, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever heard, With that song and This Is The Last Time, there were the first two songs that Tim had written them, where I felt like, oh, well, these are, there's something about these that's like a kind of step up from anything that we've done before.
Was it good to sort of like witness this, you know, I mean, to sort of like see the progression, you know,
absolutely.
In your friend?
I mean,
know?
In a way, because the thing was, before that, we'd all contributed songwriting to the process and to the band. I mean, I think Tim had always been better than everyone else. So I just remember just thinking, probably there was a part of me that was very envious, you know, if I'm being honest.
That's okay, though.
Just like, wow, I get to sing this. Also, for the most part, it was just incredibly exciting as these really great songs started to sort of roll out of him. You know, it was a lovely feeling to think, oh, I'm, you know, this is us now. This is what we can do. And I think, you know, talking of how things sort of developed and changed at that point for the band, you know, I think I went, you know, particularly armed with these new songs, I sort of went from singing, trying to, you know, before that, it was a late 90s London-based guitar band. So everyone was trying to sound like Radiohead or Pulp or whatever. It was just like, there was a very specific sound, and I think a lot of bands are falling into this trap of wanting to sound like other people. Yeah. But suddenly it felt like with these newer songs that Tim was writing, there was a chance to move away from that. And I think my voice started to really become my own at that point. I wasn't trying to be Tom York or Bono or someone, you know, I wasn't trying to be anyone else.
Yeah.
And
I mean, the vocals are very high. And it's like a falsetto. I mean, I did a whole album of falsetto stuff myself, and I was wondering, how is it for you singing that live, you know? I mean, is it natural?
Well, I find if it's a heavy schedule of touring, the first thing that goes
is a falsetto.
Because it requires so much control to be able to keep the notes, especially when they're big, long, exposed soaring notes like they are in this song.
And it's amazing when you capture it in the studio, isn't it? But you know, when live, it's like, you've got to have the monitors cranked and
But you see, you know, in truth, I mean, I think I'm very lucky. I seem to have a very loud voice, as I'm sure you're behind the scenes guys are saying. But I've got a loud and quite a strong voice. I mean, you know, mixing engineers who've worked with us over the years say, oh, it's great working with you because I never have a problem getting the vocals loud enough in shows. So, I think my voice is mercifully very robust, and generally speaking, I look forward to the challenge of those really exposed high moments and gigs. There's a certain amount of trepidation.
It is a challenge to be that exposed. Let's press play on She Has No Time by Keane. She says she has no time. She Has No Time by Keane. Any final thoughts on that track?
I remember Mark Wallace. We must have done this. Well, we did do this one with Mark Wallace. And I remember him saying to you about singing really quietly. Do you remember that? And he kept going, oh, imagine you're singing it in someone's ear.
Yeah.
And I think that, and he was just like, quieter, quieter, quieter every time. And it's, I think you can, well, as you say, you can hear that on the recording.
Yeah.
And I think that was quite a kind of breakthrough thing for us, wasn't it?
Yeah.
As well, having always been trying to sort of get people's attention quickly at gigs and stuff, I think we started to realise that there's, you know, there's another side that needs to be more to it, and that you need to have moments where you're sort of pulling them in well.
Well, you know what it's like, we're singing, you know, in the Bull and Gate in Camden or whatever, you've got a wedge and the guy has had 5 minutes to work out the sound. You know, you end up singing incredibly loudly and you kind of...
And everyone's chatting.
And everyone's chatting, All your mates are chatting. So, Tim's absolutely right. You need a totally different discipline for the studio.
Yeah, and, you know, it takes a while to learn, doesn't it?
That? Yeah, yeah.
Tim, let's pick up with track number 7 on the record. Can't Stop Now.
Well, that's one I always think upbeat. It's so sort of, it's got a great energy, that one. It's so Smithsy to me.
Right. I suppose, if you imagine Morrissey singing it, I think you definitely can.
And again, that sort of, in the lyrics, I think that sense of kind of propulsion, you know, like you're, we had this feeling of like, we're keeping going, we've got to keep going, you know, it's like we haven't got time for sort of wallowing in self-pity or whatever, and that's kind of where that came from. It's like music by the Smiths.
What's your favourite Smiths record?
Oh, blimey. I mean, I think Hatful of Hollow is the one we used to
do. Mine, actually. I like that the most as well. It's just
lovely.
Yeah, it's like just natural.
Yeah, it's a nice sort of mix of just so many amazing songs.
William, I like.
We're also listening to quite a lot of his early solo records as well at the time, aren't we? Vauxhall and I and
Southport Grammar.
Yeah, we loved those records, didn't we?
So that the small town thing that I mentioned earlier, I think, was sort of definitely something we felt sort of freed up to write about that by the Smiths. But also, like, it was a bit technical, but that sort of drum beat from like William, It Was Really Nothing, and This Charming Man was a bit like that. It was almost like quite a few of the songs had that sort of boom, 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 and we sort of basically slowed it down, and that just became the beat that we used for like This Is the Last Time, Can't Stop Now, probably about 20 Keane songs over the years. So
it's kind of quite Northern Soul, but
yeah, I guess so.
Half time,
yeah.
Which is
good point.
I've noticed that the other day about Can't Stop Now as well, is that it has this very Motown-y feel to it, especially in the recording way. Like the drums, like, remember the drums are really big, they're coming really big, and they've got this sort of huge roomy sound, but actually on the recording you can hardly hear them, it's all tambourine.
Right.
It's just a sort of tambourine going all the way through the song until the end where it gets really big, but yeah very Motown-y.
Here's that track we've been talking about, Can't Stop Now. Breaks my heart to say that I can't stop now. I've got troubles of my own, 'cause I'm short on time. I'm lonely and I'm too tired. Next track, Sunshine, is my favourite track. I think it's just that it's such a contrast. I mean, it's going along and it's very enjoyable, but then when that drops, when the sunshine drops, it kind of just, I don't know, it just opens it up even further, I suppose. It's like a new, you know, a new place to go.
It's not trying as hard or something, if you know what I mean.
But it was an early one. You said it was an early one, right?
I don't know where the sunshine was. I can't try and remember how
it was. I mean, it was... It was one we did when we were out in France.
Oh, okay.
So I suppose it was relatively early in that respect.
Right.
We wrote it. I mean, I remember just going off to sort of sitting in a field somewhere, very idyllic, with an acoustic guitar and a dictaphone, and just sort of writing that very quickly. But I think it has that sort of sunny, dreamy feel to it, doesn't it? It's not too thought about, and it probably because the lyrics were just sort of almost kind of garbled train of thought type stuff. That probably adds to the dreaminess.
Yeah. Is there a lyric that says, "Can anybody find their home?"
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's not garbled nonsense at all. I think that's kind of like, I mean, it hit me straight away.
Yeah, that's cool. Thank you.
It's funny, isn't it? Where Tim and I have been talking about lyrics a lot recently and sort of trying to find that space, because very often what kind of comes out in that sort of stream of consciousness or that initial burst when you first write a song.
Yeah,
that's the good stuff.
Yeah, something that doesn't quite work, or a misheard thing or something, or it actually becomes.
Yeah, and then you start overthinking it or overworking.
Oh yeah.
Somehow it gets further away from that sort of the beauty it had at its sort of genesis. It's sort of trying to find that sort of perfect balance where you have both. But I think that song for me definitely has that. You know, yeah, it's lovely.
You doing some live dates around?
Yeah. This,
will that be part of the live set?
I think we're intending to play them
all of it.
Yeah. But because it's as mentioned earlier, it's a front-loaded record. We thought about whether we could play it in order, but then we
probably
just
not.
Absolutely ridiculous. But it's funny because I went to see David Gray doing White Ladder and playing it from start to finish. I love that record. And I actually really enjoyed hearing it as it is on the album. There's something kind of really lovely about hearing things in order. And the same with the Flaming Lips. I saw them doing Ishimi like that. And it was...
It's a good record.
It was really great. Yeah. But it was just sort of... I think with this record, it might be a bit of a stretch to try and play it in order. So,
are you finding that's fun? Big fun?
Yeah, again, I think probably they were another band around that time who were having quite a big impact. Because I remember Chris Martin had said to you, you've got to listen to the Flaming Lips. Do you remember? And we kind of put it on and thought, this is just... We just can't make any sense of
this. Was that Yoshimi or Soft Bulletin?
Soft Bulletin.
Yeah, right.
Because they really sort of broke.
Yeah, that was the breakthrough record, yeah.
I think just that, the energy of, I don't know the name of the first song now, but.
Race to the Prize?
Yeah, exactly. It's like so, it's so sort of uplifting, such an uplifting record.
It really is.
Deep. Yeah, I think we took a lot from that.
There's lovely scrappiness to it as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Really great.
And Dave Fridman's kind of compression on the drums.
Yeah.
We love Dave so much. Yeah, so we actually went out and went to his studio in Buffalo to try and do some stuff with him sort of many years later. He's a great guy. He was not what we expected, was he? Do you remember?
Very unassuming.
Very unassuming. Yeah. But yeah, we had a lovely, very cold time, didn't we, when we were there, sort of minus 15 degrees or so. You go outside and you felt your lungs were completely frozen.
What came out of the session?
It was on Strangeland, so our fourth record. We didn't end up using any of it. It was just part of a longer process.
So I think
some of it got, one of the songs got re-released as a sort of record store day thing later on. Well, that we'd done with Dave, yeah.
We did steal a few bits, I think, from that session.
Added 22 tracks with Dave Fridman.
Right,
cool.
But all sort of like, all by telephone. I mean, I sent him some stuff to mix and stuff, and he'd do it overnight, and then, you know, I'd have to sort of like listen to it and make notes and send it back. And
Yeah. And
I think we did like 22 tracks in 25 days or something.
Wow.
Pretty good. Pretty good.
That's
going.
Great.
Yes. So I like him a lot. But I didn't actually meet him. It was just like, you know, just by FaceTime.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good guy.
Very nice.
Had to control the compression quite a lot. Yeah. Not everything needed to explode, you know, but it was. It's great. Time for a song. Here's the eighth song from Hopes and Fears, Sunshine. Sunshine by Keane on Absolute Radio. Up next is another big song. This is The Last Time. Tom, what can you tell me about this?
It sort of seemed to be like one of the very first songs that we had that really felt like a sort of step up.
And it was a single, right?
It became a single, didn't it? Yeah. I think eventually.
Yeah, maybe what, third single?
It's just sort of, I mean, it's funny because at the time when Hopes and Fears came out, obviously we went from really worrying that we were never going to get anywhere to, you know, overnight then having this kind of total... I mean, I just suddenly had such self-belief or belief in what we were doing.
Yeah.
But I remember at the time thinking, I think we had four or five singles from Hopes and Fears, and they all got played on radio. They were all kind of all A-listed on all those stations.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, oh, this is just the way it's always going to be. Do you know what I mean? It's a sort of when you're in that space and it's kind of new and you're not sort of, well, you're very naive, like I guess I was at the time. It sort of felt like, oh, this is it now. This is the way that it's always going to be. But I think it was actually very rarefied air that we were breathing for a short while. It definitely was a single at some point, maybe the third or fourth
single
off the record.
Third single, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's, I associate that with Tom and I used to work in this different offices in the same building in Covent Garden, where we were like sort of dog's body for our respective departments at this book publishers.
I still can't remember what I used to do there. I don't even know where that.
Not a lot of those.
It was called data entry, but I never actually don't remember what that involved. Just nonsense. Yeah. Anyway,
But I remember having that song going around in my head when we were there and feeling quite excited about it and feeling that it was very catchy. But then I also did a demo of it, which was still floating around somewhere. And it, you know, it sounds all right, and everything's there.
Is it going to make it on the box set?
I think we used a different one, because that's another song, because it was quite an early one.
Yeah.
That went through a lot of permutations.
Yeah. I think a very Morrissey vocal of yours.
Yeah, it's very sort of slurry and, you know, I don't know if I'm trying to be a sort of mix of Morrissey and Tom York or something. But it made me think about how amazing it is to have Tom as a singer, because basically everything, you make anything sound good. Basically,
I don't know if that's true, but it's what you need to say.
But you know, you can imagine that you wouldn't have been able to tell, I don't think, from the first demo that it would have that sort of huge, sort of soaring quality to it. But I think, you know, it was very thrilling to hear it when you started singing it, and you got these big notes at the beginning of the chorus, and it's the same live. It's like so exciting.
A special combination,
isn't
it?
Tim singing on the demo, like it was the big note is like an A, so it's right at the top of your limit. I guess you were probably doing it falsetto.
Exactly,
it's like, as soon as I heard it, it's like, right, I'm going to hit this full chest voice. You know, it's
nailed it.
Proper epic moment. Yeah.
Let's hear This Is the Last Time. That was This Is the Last Time on Tim's Listening Party. Tim, the next track is On a Day Like Today.
I don't remember a lot about that one, actually, I have to admit, except that I think that it's another one where, if it wasn't on the album, it would be a real loss somehow. I wouldn't say it's my favourite Keane song, but it's the fact that it goes off on this sort of dreamy journey, and it's got all these sort of very echoey voices, and it builds and builds. It's quite spacey, and I think maybe a bit like Sunshine. It's a bit different from Sunshine.
They both
serve that job of like just making the record something other than just sort of 3 minute banger after 3 minute banger for 12 songs. You know, it just sort of takes you into a different world.
The album does seem to do that anyway, doesn't it? It sort of drifts into a more dreamy sort of landscape sonically, I think, as it goes on.
Yeah.
At least that's how I remember it, having not listened to it.
I mean, it's so important to sort of structure an album to allow all that, you know, to come through, right? I mean, you know, for the singles to be the singles, and for the dreamy stuff to be the dreamy stuff, the closer to be the closer, and the, you know, and it's track seven, everyone knows how important track seven is, you know.
Yeah. I was seeing that, like, so many people, we were completely obsessed with OK Computer, and, you know, people would always have this debate about Fit or Happier. Do you remember that? It's like, is that sort of spoken one?
Right.
You know, you'd always sort of want to fast forward it, but somehow it was such a part of the journey of the album.
That
if it wasn't there, it would, you know, be a completely different album.
Do you think like that? You know, you just mentioned that it's not your favourite, but it needs to be on there. Do you apply that rule to other albums?
I think of our own, you mean?
Yeah, of course,
Sometimes I think we could have applied it a bit more.
That's funny.
But, you know, it's the same. The thing is that I don't think we were really thinking about it at the
time. Okay, so it's subconscious,
as Tom said earlier, it gets harder and harder not to be second-guessing yourself, and you're always thinking. We have this phrase, one more rocker, which we used to use when we first
just
started doing the
gigs. Just need one more rocker. Every time I played a live show, it was like, oh, I just need one more rocker.
Yeah.
And then it became the same with albums, didn't it?
Yeah.
Right.
So it's easy to forget that you need moments that take you on a different road for a bit.
Well, let's play it. This is the all-important track number 10 on Hopes and Fears. It's On a Day Like Today. Next is Untitled One. Is it the Untitled One or Untitled Number One?
That's got to be a Logic thing, is it?
It's probably, yeah. It's probably sort of an unnamed file.
Yeah, because, yeah.
And then we probably thought, oh, that sounds a bit arty.
Yeah.
Let's just go with that.
Untitled One from Unnamed File.
Yeah.
I like it.
Because actually, Logic, the computer software, sort of came out. Or at least we started using it around sort of 2001, didn't we? We got our first Mac and started using it then. I'm sure it was just... That was just what it was saved as, wasn't it?
Yeah, that sounds right. There's another one we did in France. Again, I think it has that sort of sunny, dreamy quality to it. You know, almost not quite sure what it all means. But
I guess it's quite dancey, I think.
Very Roixop-y, like that beat is very... Now I think about it, I feel like the whole album's basically sort of Roixop tribute album.
I was wondering whether it was like a Fender 6 that was involved in that.
Oh, I don't know, yeah. It was probably... I don't even know what that guitar...
I can't even remember what the guitar's doing. Sort of,
it just goes like down, down, down.
Oh! Oh, my God. You don't think it was like... Something maybe crazy like the PSR 48 for a kind of weird. We had this terrible this keyboard that was just like, it was a very basic Yamaha sort of starter keyboard, wasn't it? That you had from when you were probably 11 or 12 or something. But I used to like it because it used to have, like, you know, sound effects like breaking glass and
car horn.
But I'm sure we ended up using it in weird sort of ways by putting it as time went on. It's like, why don't we put the PSR through some weird effects?
I love that.
Yeah, so it sort of takes on a new life. I probably totally misremembered that, but I'm going to say that's what it was.
References to the afterlife as well.
Yeah, I think there is a bit of that.
Throughout the album, really.
Yeah, I mean, partly I studied classics at university.
Yeah.
One of the many cool things I've done. But I think there's a bit of that is always sort of lurking. But also, you know, Tom mentioned David Gray earlier, and I remember we were all really into White Ladder when that came out. I remember you sort of was walking around the flat going, "Meet me on the other side."
Oh, right. I don't think that's his. I'm not sure that is from White Ladder. Yeah, White Ladder. That might be the follow up. But I know the song you mean.
Yeah, so I think that lodged itself, and that phrase crops up a few times, as you say.
Let's hear the penultimate track on the album, Untitled One. Untitled One by Keane. That brings us to the penultimate track of Hopes and Fears, Bedshaped.
Bedshaped.
Yeah, that was another earlier one, wasn't it?
Yeah. I remember first running through that at Vine Hall, I think. Mm. Or maybe first tinkering with that. So my parents ran a school. So in the holidays, it was completely deserted and it had this theatre.
Oh, fantastic.
So we used to set up in there and. It was mad because they did like kind of summer concerts. They had this like Burzendorfer grand piano. It was like a proper bit of kit, you know, 100 grand piano. I remember sitting in there one summer's night and Tim playing this song, Bedshaped, to me, and just thinking, oh, that is a beautiful song. And I think, again, talking about like people around us really not believing in us, I remember, like, my dad was always very
supportive.
No, the opposite.
The opposite. Wow. Oh.
He was almost, or well, I think he, you know, he was.
Was that a driving force? Do you think?
No, maybe. Yeah. I certainly found it very demoralising in a way that he. And why with that? But at the same time, looking back, I think they just didn't understand the world that we were in, or yeah. we were trying to be in. They couldn't make sense of it. And yeah, so but I think it was galvanising. I think I did feel like, well, you know,
I'll show you.
Yeah. But I remember first playing that song to my dad, who's, you know, sort of a English literature buff, you know, he's sort of very well read and all that. And I remember him saying, the lyrics to these are actually, this song is, they're really good. And I'm thinking, oh, this is...
Point proved.
This is something a bit different, you know, to hear even him. Of course, actually, weirdly enough, the lovely thing was that once we became successful and they could see the world that we were trying to occupy, they've been, like, our biggest supporters, and it's been lovely to see. But, yeah, they found it very alien and very difficult to understand, I think, to begin with.
Mm.
Yeah, but again, that song, I mean, I just love that song on almost every level, really.
It's a banger.
I still love singing it live. It starts so intimate and becomes so epic, and it always feels like we often play it. I mean, it's at the end of the album, and we often play it at the end of a set, and it just it always feels like a very emotional moment. There's something about that to me, it sort of feels, I always thought of it as a song about growing old. And I think, you know, I was sort of look out when we're playing live, was look out at couples for some reason. It was, you know, sort of sense where, you know, we're going to grow old together. I mean again, Tim will be able to illuminate you on the on what it's saying lyrically, but to me it's always said that.
Well, I think there is some of that. I think, yeah, I had this sense of, like, and I think everybody's changing is a bit like this, when you're young, or the sort of the age we were kind of in our mid-20s, you often find you're sort of parting ways from people that you grew up with. Uh-huh. And you go off and live in different parts of the country or get different jobs or whatever it might be, or, you know, relationships. And I think I had this feeling of, like, that, you know, we'll be reunited one day.
Yeah.
Was, I think, the thought that was flowing through it for me. I had this, the thing I remember about it is Tom saying, oh, I've read this interview of Tom York where he was saying that if you play all the black notes on the piano, it's much easier and everything sounds good. And I was like, oh, great. Shortcuts to sounding good and sound like Radiohead. Definitely give that a go. I think that's why it goes to quite a weird chord in the chorus.
Yeah.
And it's quite a weird song, actually, in that respect.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, lads, we've got to wrap it up. And it's been fantastic talking to you. And thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Tim.
And celebrating a great record. Brilliant record.
Thank you so much.
Let's finish with a brilliant closer of Hopes and Fears, Bedshaped. That was Keen and Bedshaped, concluding this listening party. Thanks to Tom Chaplin and Tim Rice-Oxley for joining me on this episode of my listening party to tell me about Hopes and Fears. Let me finish this episode by giving you a handful of listening recommendations to keep your ears busy. The first thing that comes to mind is Dent May and Pearl and the Oysters. So it's like a collaboration, and the song's called Time Flies When You're Having Fun. I first came across Dent May could I call him Dent? First came across Dent May a couple of years ago with his album Across the Multiverse, which is just lovely and great and very sunshine pop and perfect for spring. The next recommendation is XTC and the song that I've been listening to quite a lot on my earphones, earbuds, whatever, is the song's called That Is The Way, and it's from the album Drums and Wires. And XTC, great post-punk band, and yeah, I really like that one at the moment. Changing the scene from post-punk to I guess, traditional folk, pretty much. Pentangle, Light Flight, and that's from the album Basket of Light. Just a gorgeous record. I think all you keen listeners would like this. And my final song of choice for this episode would be Richard and Linda Thompson. Maybe I am going through a kind of folky phase, but this is I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight, and it's a gorgeous song. I think it's from the either from the 70s or the 80s, but, you know, I could Google it, but I'm not going to. Don't forget, if you've tuned in late and missed any of this evening's show or want to replay any of the previous listening parties, just search and follow Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts. There, you'll find a whole archive of listening parties with the likes of New Order talking about Power Corruption and Lies, Texas talking about White on Blonde, and Simple Minds talking about New Gold Dream. Tonight's listening party may be over, but you can keep getting in touch by tweeting me using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party. Every song is taken from Keane's Hopes and Fears. All tracks are written by Tim Rice-Oxley, Tom Chaplin and Richard Hughes, except She Has No Time, Sunshine, This Is The Last Time and Bedshapes are also credited to James Sanger. The album was released on Island in May 2004. I'm Tim Burgess and thanks for listening. I'll see you next time for another listening party.
Absolute Radio, telling the story behind another iconic album with Tim Burgess.
Get involved using the hashtag Tim's Twitter Listening Party.